Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Super Tuesday doesn't end it. The Keystone Pipeline goes down again. Israel's leader comes calling. Greece squeaks out a debt deal. Mitt Romney won 6 of 10 Super Tuesday contests, but there's still a lot of pushing and shoving out there. It's no cakewalk.
We're counting up the delegates for the convention, and it looks good. And we're counting down the days until November, and that looks even better.
In his first press conference of the year, President Obama warned GOP nominees against loose talk of war with Iran.
If some of these folks think that it's time to launch a war, they should say so. And they should explain to the American people exactly why they would do that and what the consequences would be. Everything else is just talk.
And Georgetown law student Sandra Fluke did not accept an apology from Rush Limbaugh for his vitriolic personal attacks.
I don't think that a statement like this issued saying that his choice of words was not the best changes anything.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Jessica Yellen of CNN, Margaret Carlson of Bloomberg News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. From Washington, we're joined today by Jessica Yellen, chief White House correspondent for CNN. Jessica, great to have you here. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Margaret Carlson joins us from Washington as well, political columnist for Bloomberg News. Welcome back, Margaret.
Thank you, Tom. And this time, I actually have a voice. You may remember last time I had laryngitis.
Yes, I do. Welcome back with voice in throat. It's great to have it right there. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Jessica, and Margaret.
Let's listen together for just a second here, if we may, to the kind of waterfall of Republican observations this week about where things are going. And here's Newt Gingrich right away. He's under pressure from GOP conservatives, some of them. Gary Bauer calling for him to bow out. And Rick Santorum supporters get out of the race. Here he is at a rally on Wednesday in Montgomery, Alabama, part of his southern turf, saying he would do no such thing.
We are staying in this race because I believe that it's going to be impossible for a moderate to win the general election. And I believe we tried it in 1996 and it didn't work. We tried it in 2008 and it didn't work. You can't have somebody where the gap between RomneyCare and Obamacare is so narrow that you can't figure out what the debate is.
Right. There's Newt Gingrich. Okay, now right next door, Tupelo, Mississippi, Rick Santorum on the stump, kind of calling out to Newt, saying, hey, support me, not Newt, and maybe Newt, get out of this race. Here's Rick.
I'm asking for your help and support on Tuesday. You do that. You deliver a victory for us on Tuesday. You will make this a two-person race, and once it's a two-person race, the conservative will be the nominee. You can change it all, Mississippi.
Well, two-person race only if it doesn't have Newt, and for that matter, Ron Paul, but Newt, I guess, above all. Here's Mitt Romney saying, hey, we're going to do it. This was his victory speech on Tuesday night.
There'll be good days, there'll be bad days. Always long hours, never enough time to get everything done. But on November 6th, we're going to stand united, not only having won an election, but having saved a future.
Save the future, no less, and maybe it will be Mitt Romney. But just yesterday on NBC's Today Show, here's former Republican Congressman Joe Scarborough, MSNBC, saying he's still looking for a white knight for the GOP race. Somebody to sweep in. Here's the exchange with Ann Curry first.
If you were head of the Republican Party trying to defeat Barack Obama in November, well, okay, but would you be also asking any one of these candidates to get out?
No, I actually, and I'm dead serious, I would be asking others to get into the race. I'd be asking, still be asking, Jeb Bush, Chris Christie, Paul Ryan, or somebody else.
Somebody else, it sounds like anybody else. Margaret Carlson, take us in here. What have we learned this week? Is this going all the way to June, July, August, September? Where does this end?
Well, the narrative was that if Mitt Romney won Ohio, it would be over. And of course, he won Ohio, but very narrowly. And the press doesn't want it to be over, and it isn't over. It just there's no one except Mitt Romney who wants it to be over. He made a bad impression when I'm listening to your very good clips there. You would know that Gingrich and Santorum were speaking. You know their voices.
Yeah.
They are distinct. Mm-hmm. Mitt Romney has the voice of an accountant. And the next day, all of everything that was coming from Romney and the Romney camp were spreadsheets about the delegate count and inevitability and the math. The press can do the math for you and talk about those things. There was not, and it played into the impression that we have of Romney, which is that he's not fully human and he doesn't connect and he talks about eating grits in the wrong way in Alabama or Mississippi, wherever he was in the South yesterday. He doesn't have a voice. Joe Scarborough and others have a story that they're writing, and it is in all of our interest to have the white knight enter the race. It would be exciting. A brokered convention is the wrong word, but a new person coming in would make Mitt's inevitability go away, and we'd all be excited. Mitt Romney is, and I hate to be the buzz killer here, so you can turn my mic off.
Bring it on, Margaret, bring it on.
He's going to be the nominee. I'm really, really sorry, because it ends our story in a way. But the story will go on in other ways because he is the weakest front runner slash nominee we've had in a very long time.
Hey, Jessica, jump in here. I mean, how do you see this? Here we are. Look, sometimes it's hard to figure out a new angle on this. I think some in the press would be just as happy if this did go away. But do you see this long Republican slog as a creation of the press hungry for an ongoing story, or as a sort of demonstration of a real struggle inside the GOP, Jessica?
It's a little bit of both. There is an internal war going on inside the Republican Party right now with this sort of unaligned populism that's grown up in the form of the Tea Party on the right, and it's trying to find where it should settle itself. Is it going to be in a sort of moral majority person with Rick Santorum? Is it going to settle on Newt Gingrich? How will these men capitalize on that energy? And obviously, Mitt Romney has the organization, the backing, and the reach to become the nominee. And that's why I'm in full agreement with Margaret that he ultimately will be the nominee. This whole notion of a brokered convention, a white knight, is a total media fabrication. It is not going to happen. And I don't say that because I know it intuitively. I say it because I talk to the people who have the deep pocket financing, who are running the super PACs and writing the checks, and they don't want it to happen, and they will not allow it to happen. And the candidates that they talk about, the Mitch Daniels, the Jeb Bushes, those people don't want to get in. So who's going to get in? You know, it's not an option.
It's just not going to happen. We'll come to that. Jack Beatty, I mean, super PACs, we're looking at the numbers here. They spent more than the candidates themselves, and by a long shot, three times as much on these recent races. But what do you see here this week? What have you learned? I'm looking at your former first lady way back, Barbara Bush. She was at a conference of first ladies in Dallas. She called this 2012 GOP contest, Barbara Bush says, the worst campaign I've ever seen in my life. Maybe just because it goes on and on and on. What have we learned here, Jack?
Well, I think, first of all, we did learn that Mr. Romney had a good night on Tuesday. He won the most votes, most delegates, most states. And for the first time in the NBC poll, he's now leading in the horse race at 38% nationally, his highest ever ranking. And if the race is reduced to two candidates, which seems to be the feared denouement here, he's still ahead of Santorum by 5 points, and he's doing better among Tea Party supporters than he ever has. And 72% of Republicans now say they'd be satisfied with him as the nominee. So all that's good news for him. On the other hand, he's got a rendezvous with electoral indignity coming up for the rest of the month. He's going to lose in Kansas, in Alabama, in Mississippi, in Louisiana, and all that until he gets to Illinois, where he probably has a good shot. So none of that is going to look good. And if that isn't going to look good, his prospects for the fall really have taken a beating. He said, this primary is making me a stronger candidate. The numbers don't say that. He's at 28% favorable, lowest of any candidate in recent years at this point. And just sort of looking at other numbers, his only 14% of Hispanics favor him. 35% voted for John McCain, 44% for George W. Bush. Mm. He's in trouble. This campaign has hurt him.
Jack, we know Newt Gingrich's history. We know his pride. Why do you think he's hanging in here? I mean, Santorum practically calling out explicitly for him to get out of the race, and many others doing it explicitly, Gary Bauer, conservative activist, and others. What keeps Gingrich in, Jack?
Well, we know that the Sheldon Adelson money is crucial there. The Las
Vegas mogul, yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And the Wall Street Journal has reported, interestingly, that this is partly because Adelson likes Gingrich and feels he owes him and wants to support him. It's also because he does not want Rick Santorum. And he realizes that the longer Newt is viable, he'll split the conservative vote and give the and help Mr. Romney secure the nomination, so that Sheldon Adelson is playing a kind of complicated chess game with his paying off a friend and preventing someone he doesn't want from getting the nomination.
Margaret Carlson, no way, no how for Rick Santorum, even if Newt Gingrich and Callista went on a Grecian holiday tomorrow. No way.
I'm sure they'd buy the tickets. Gingrich is, aside from all the reasons Jack just gave us, if you watch him, he is a happy warrior. He is so delighted for the attention, which he can get no other way, that I think he's going nowhere. You know, he says the worst things. Oh, we're all headed for doom and disaster. Yeah. But he says them with great delight. happy to be in the debates, happy to be campaigning. He's just got no incentive to leave.
In his element, Margaret Carlson with Bloomberg, stand by Jessica Yellen with CNN. Jack Beatty, this is On Point. The president had a big press conference this week, his first of the year. Among those asking questions was Jessica Yellen, who's with us right here. She asked the president about the Republicans and whether he believed they were waging a war on women. Jessica, we heard Jon Stewart go after you on that, saying this is instigative, not investigative journalism. We'll talk about that. Who knows? But here's the president in his response to Jessica Yellen's question at the White House.
Women are going to make up their own mind in this election about who is advancing the issues that they care most deeply about. One of the things I've learned being married to Michelle is I don't need to tell her what it is that she thinks is important. There are millions of strong women around the country who are going to make their own determination about a whole range of issues.
The president at his press conference this week. Jessica Yellen, what do you make of that whole issue? And the way with Rush and the other stuff in the air, this is playing out for Republicans, playing out for Democrats.
Well, I'll say first, I was shocked by the president's response. I really thought he would take it as an opportunity to run with the issue, which they've been doing.
The Democratic National Committee and others, yeah.
Who have been arguing that there has been a war on women, and I guess he's letting his surrogates go out and say that, but he wants to step back and take the higher ground. The bottom line with this is it seems that his healthcare law pushed the administration to make at some point a determination on how contraceptives would be covered. And when they came out with their rule, they were really ham-handed about how they handled it. They didn't brief the religious people who were close to the administration about how they were going to do this outreach with the Catholic community, how they were going to make religious institutions comply with this rule. So the rollout was just a mess. Even they had been warned this would be a problem, and apparently they just didn't heed the advice of those who warned them. So you saw what went down. The initial politics of it seemed to, you know, backfire in the White House's face. It was a passed as a, you know, insensitive to religious concern.
Yep.
And then quickly, the Republicans took this and turned it into a contraception war. And the politics of it shifted entirely into the Democrats' hands and to the Democrats' benefit, because one of the key swing votes this election season is going to be suburban women. And for suburban women, contraception and access to contraception and, you know, just the idea that anybody would mess with that is upsetting and annoying. And so it became a political winner for Democrats because Republicans just bungled the politics of it with the amendments, the Blunt Amendment in the Senate.
Yep.
And more. So the White House and the Democratic Committee and others have been running with this issue. And you're seeing the president now speaking at Barnard College for their commencement. And they're really, the Democratic Committee announcing an institute on women now. So they're really trying to drive this issue home. But the president himself trying to obviously keep a hands-off approach at the press conference.
Margaret, you've been writing pretty saucy on this. You wrote, you have to wonder if the party that's been obsessed with lady parts for the better part of a month can bring enough women in Independence Home in November to beat President Barack Obama. How do you see this playing out, Margaret?
Well, first of all, kudos to Jessica for the cameo. I was on Jon Stewart. I was rooting for you, and you're instigating. However, you can see why
that instigating? I mean, they've been talking about a war on women. Isn't it a fair game to ask about it? Ask the president?
Absolutely. And you would think the president might take it, but I think he didn't take the question because, as Jessica points out, Democrats are doing fine on this. It's Republicans who snatched defeat from the jaws of victory. They were on the side of the bishops. The president folded. Then they went too far. Why in the world would you put out the Blunt Amendment? First of all, I can't think of the eponymous Blunt Amendment. It's so blunt. You're giving every boss in America the ability to impose his conscience on his entire workforce. Isn't that a little crazy? The Church of Burger King is going to tell you what you can have and what you can't have when all prescription drugs are covered. I mean, I know we'll get to Rush Limbaugh, but I bet the EIB network covers Viagra, but then wouldn't cover birth control, and they're both prescription drugs. In any event, Democrats have this. I'm amazed that Republicans would do this. It's a 1950s argument. It makes no sense. I don't get it. It makes no sense to have it. They have the people who consider contraception part of the war on abortion. They already have those votes. And now they're losing, as Jessica points out, the independent women in the suburbs.
You mentioned Rush. Let's go to him right here. You know, 49 sponsors or something like that pulling ads for his show. But he said on the air, look, I got sponsors coming out my ear. I got thousands of sponsors. It's like losing a French fry. This all about over the comments he made about contraception and Sandra Fluke.
28 sponsors out of 18,000. That's like losing a couple of French fries in the container when it's delivered to you at the drive-thru. You don't even notice it.
Boy, that reverb, it makes it sound like the voice of God or the Wizard of Oz. I'm not sure. We'll come to that. David in Oak Grove, Kentucky is calling. David, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to point out something. I've been a Southern Baptist for all my life. I'm almost 58 years old.
Okay.
And as I look at the political spectrum and have talked it over amongst Southern Baptists that I know and other Baptists, they have problems voting for a Mormon for president, and they have strong feelings because they still consider Mormonism a cult. And there's no real leader that has really captured their heart. And I've tried to talk to them about Ron Paul, who I think has recently become a Baptist, but they reject him because of his libertarian views.
What about Mr. Gingrich, Mr. Santorum, David?
Presidential race is divided up, and they can't have a solidarity to come against Obama, don't you think?
Well, I don't know. Does it seem fair to hold Mr. Romney's religion against him when he's running for a secular office, president of the United States? Maybe fairness isn't the issue.
I don't know if it's fair or not, but I'm telling you that is the prejudice that you have with a lot of Baptists, and that's one of the major evangelical groups in America.
And certainly very strong in the South, where the primaries are turning next. We're going to see very soon how that turns out and see what the exit polls tell us when the votes actually come. David, I appreciate your call. Wendy in Boston. Wendy, thanks. You're on the air.
Thanks. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to point out that, you know, I'm a suburban woman. I am an independent. I voted for Obama last race. And it just strikes me when I look at this Republican race and I listen to the commentary on Santorum and Romney and Newt Gingrich that the person who's going to be successful in Washington is the person who can be more moderate, who's going to find a way to collaborate and negotiate and pull the Congress together. And that is never going to be in a person like Rick Santorum, who has such radical views.
But that's supposed to be Mitt Romney. So are you ready to lean Romney, Wendy?
Yeah, if I had to choose in the Republican race, I'm leaning Romney, and I think it's just interesting to me that the lack of emotion in his voice, the numbers that he runs by. I mean, he's a very smart individual. He's a businessman. I'm not sure why that is the thing that we're holding against him, and to the last caller's point, why we would hold his religious beliefs against him.
And Wendy, I appreciate your call. Jack Beatty, I mean, there it is, sort of the real Baptist base in this case versus the independent who might want to get in and vote Republican, leaning Romney.
Yes, in the South, I think it's something like 27-28%. Mr. Romney hasn't done any better than that down there. And conjecture has been, it's been because of this resistance to his religion. However, I do think that in the fall, the base of the Republican Party, the Southern evangelical base, is certainly, if they put the Mormonism aside next to Barack Obama, I can't imagine them not voting and voting in numbers for Mr. Romney. At least that's what people say. And on the independent grounds, yeah, I mean, that's been his implicit plea to primary voters. Look, you may not agree with me. You may think I'm too moderate, but I'm electable. These other guys aren't. That's been the argument. The trouble is the Republican primaries have been what David Brooks calls a heresy trial. if you wonder, if you say anything that's even slightly heretical that disturbs the base, but that would go over very well in November, you're in trouble. And I think that this has left Mr. Romney looking so inauthentic because he can't really be himself. The governor of Massachusetts, who was a very effective governor from all reports and who pushed through a highly effective health care reform, can't do that. And he strikes these tin notes when he tries to sound radically conservative. It's a tough spot for him.
Said he didn't want to set his hair on fire with that stuff. And yet, Jason in Plymouth, Massachusetts. Jason, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. First off, I think Rush Limbaugh is ignorant and an idiot, but call him what you want. I agree with Bill Maher here. He's apologized, and I think liberals just have to let it go and put their energy into some actions that show the hypocrisy of old men, running state governments. Like I saw last night as a state senator in Virginia who's put forward a bill that requires a rectal exam for any men getting a Viagra prescription. And there's a state rep in Illinois.
Yeah.
Who requires that's putting a bill together that says anybody that gets a Viagra prescription has to watch a movie about erectile dysfunction and erections lasting over 4 hours.
Looking here, maybe facetiously, but maybe not, but for parallels to the vaginal exams for women who are considering abortion or having to look at the movies. Jason, let me take it to the women right here. Time to let it go, Margaret Carlson, Rush Limbaugh, and his what was it, nearly 50 different pretty hot statements on Ms. Fluke.
Well, at the risk of being flucked myself or fluked, however you want to pronounce the name, this time, we're so used to outrage speech and people like Rush Limbaugh and Bill Maher, for that matter, using it that we don't know when they're going over the line. They don't know. What Rush Limbaugh did was so far over the line. His protestations about it. I have 18,000 advertisers. I mean, who has that many advertisers? And there were silent spots on his show yesterday. So nobody quite knows what that is, but could it be where, the ads go? And there has, I think that like Don Imus, he went too far. And the joke that I assume it was a joke that the caller made. I mean, when you do put it on the other foot, you do see how, women are being treated differently in this argument over prescription drugs than men. And I think it does last. And Rush Limbaugh should be ostracized. And the apology, I don't fault it for not being a sincere apology when he was kind of browbeaten into it. But nonetheless, it's almost something you can't even apologize for when you take somebody's daughter and treat them like that.
And when they're not really much of a public figure, sort of pulled up and beaten up. Jessica, I mean, our listeners have been pointing out, here's Rush Limbaugh, four wives he's had, no children. Kind of an odd spokesman on the contraception front here. But do you think he's really in trouble, Jessica? Or is this just, you know, a rough week for Rush and he'll be back in the saddle and rolling on?
Well, I keep wondering where all these fellas' ex-girlfriends are and if they're going to come out of the woodwork talking about their past, perhaps contraceptive use and what their own history was. I do think you used the word diminished earlier, and I have to imagine that this was a sort of have you no shame moment for him. And as Margaret pointed out, there was silence on the radio. So there are clearly advertisers, it would seem, who have fled. But, you know, he's not the only one who crosses the line consistently. And finally, if you ask a question he doesn't like in the press briefing, he's gone on the radio before. He's called me a feminazi for asking questions he doesn't like. And this is just sort of standard. He does this. So it's like, as she says, it's just what he does. And at some point, maybe this is where he's getting a little bit of blowback. But there are other people out there who are engaging in similar behavior, and maybe people will start watching their mouths a little bit. You know, Bill Maher has said some things that are a little over the top, and maybe he'll be a little more careful, too.
Jack Beatty, do you see wind headed out of Rush Limbaugh's sails ultimately here, or just a moment's, you know, huffing?
I just can't gauge it. I don't hear him, and I don't know how his listeners respond to him. And when I do turn it, when I have in the past listened to him, he treats his callers as if they're clones of himself. There's a kind of insane narcissism. He calls them ditto heads. You know, they want
point of pride.
They want to have his views. And you know, just on this question of the ads, Media Matters, which is not a friend of the Limbaugh Show or by any means, said that of the 86 ads that made it on the air on Wednesday, 77 of them in the 3 hours were free public service announcements donated by the Ad Council, and just two in that entire 3 hours were purposefully paid for. Well, that suggests he's taken a real hit, not just a temporary one, or that it could be. So we don't know.
Margaret, how do you guess it, Margaret? If we come back here in a year, will it be Rush with his 15 or 20 million in the same spot or something else?
Well, remember Don Imus. He engaged in a lot of, you know, very vibrant language. And then he stole the moment of victory from the Rutgers women basketball team by calling mm-hmm. them nappy-headed hoes. Mm-hmm. He went off the air, and then he came back on in some form, but certainly not with the prominence or the position he had. I don't know if this is the moment. It should be. It seems to me this falls into that category, non-public person going after them in the most vile language. And let me just mention, just go off topic, Mitt Romney had the perfect sister soldier moment, and he let it go. All he said was, I wouldn't have used that language. Oh, what? He would have called her a lady of the night? What language is he talking about? And that's what I mean about Mitt Romney not having the right instincts. He doesn't know how to respond to something that is truly beyond the pale.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, a YouTube video, Kony 2012, goes super viral on warlord Joseph Kony of the Lord's Resistance Army in Uganda. More than 50 million views in 3 days. That is social media.
You have to make it the biggest story in the world.
You're my devil, you're my angel, you're my heaven, you're my...
We have no option but to stop the LRA.
We need to do something even crazier to finish the job.
Colts quarterback and Super Bowl champ Peyton Manning was sidelined last season with a neck injury. Now he's leaving Indianapolis after 14 years.
I've been a cult for almost all of my adult life. But I guess in life and in sports, we all know that nothing lasts forever. Times change, circumstances change, and that's the reality of playing in the NFL.
And Robert Sherman, who wrote many big Disney songs with his brother Richard, died this week at 86. They won an Oscar in 1964 for their score for Mary Poppins with this bit of business. Yeehaw, we're looking at a week in the news. Super Tuesday, Obama and his loose talk of war warning. No, again, to the Keystone Pipeline, calls for a Syria intervention. Jessica, take us to that meeting between the president and the prime minister this week, the U.S. and Israel. We all saw them sitting in the White House with that exchange before they went into private talks. It's kind of hard to read what's really going on here, Jessica. Where do you think things stand at the end of this week?
Well, it does seem that they bought at least a little more time, that the U.S. bought more time, that if the Israel was planning on taking action, as it seems Secretary Panetta indicated the U.S. had believed that they were taking action sometime in spring, there is a little bit more breathing space now. There is no doubt that there is this disagreement between the two parties on the imminence or the need to take action quickly. Israel believes that, you know, they want, because of their small size, because of the limits of their military, they want to be able to hit Iran before they have the ability to put a nuclear weapon together, and that's, you know, sometime this year. And the U.S. just doesn't want that. For the president, it's a discretionary war. You know, for Israel, it's an existential question, but there are internal politics in Israel too. And so some of this, you have to wonder how much of it is public posturing, because Netanyahu's own ministers are in disagreement about this. He's getting conflicting advice from his own advisors. And so, you know, I was talking to a lot of the Israeli columnists who came over here with him, and they think that this is a bluff, that Netanyahu's really not committed to attacking Iran and trying to really scare the U.S. into ratcheting up sanctions, which we have done, ratcheting up the world pressure on Iran, and has been quite successful at doing that.
Jack, jump in here. Do you see a good cop, bad cop routine going on, a bluff? I mean, the president said some pretty big things between his talks with Mr. Netanyahu and his speech to AIPAC. He said no to containment quite definitively. That is, the U.S., he said, would not let Iran get a nuclear weapon and then just deal with it. He said very strongly to Israel, we've got your back. What do you see actually unfolding here, Jack?
Well, yesterday, Ma'ariv, an Israeli newspaper, reported that a secret understanding was made between the two leaders, in which the United States would give Israel these bunker-busting bombs, and Israel wouldn't use them this year, but would have them to use next year. The president would get through his election, and they would deal with their problem. That was denied yesterday by the White House. So who knows what commitments or what the substance of the conversation was between these men. But as to the point you raised, Tom, the president saying so firmly no to containment, and then he gave his rationales. And, you know, the rationales, well, he says it's contrary. Iran's getting a bomb would be contrary to my non-proliferation goals. That five other countries, I could name four or five other countries that leaders have told me will go after a bomb in the Middle East if Iran gets one. Well, you know, there have been blind quotes in the press from Arab diplomats saying that's nonsense, that Saudi Arabia wouldn't go out and get a bomb, that Egypt wouldn't, that Kuwait wouldn't. And his other statement was, you know, that there is the same argument the Bush people made about Saddam Hussein, there fictitiously or wrongly, which is nothing could prevent Iran from handing off these weapons to terrorists. There are certainly terrorists. They're connected with Iran. But is that a likely scenario? The point is, because this involves Israel, there's going to be no debate about it in our politics. And I think it behooves the press to start digging into this and questioning and looking at these rationales, you know, before it's too late.
Well, I mean, no debate. I mean, it seems like there's been plenty of talk in this week, certainly, about where things may be going. Margaret Carlson, what do you see coming here?
What Obama got this week was to do the public reassurance to Israel. Our bond is unbreakable. We have your back. And then publicly also, there's some enough distance between us and Israel on the Iran question that, to go back to your original question, Obama gets to be not a good cop, but a slightly better one than Israel, so that you have Israel looking like something of a wild card with their more extreme position on nukes and Iran. Like you can't do anything. You can't have a shred of uranium enriched. And the United States trying to be a little more diplomatic and leave some room. Our position is a little bit more, you know, you cannot have a nuclear weapon, but we aren't going to bomb you yet. And we had a little glimmer. I don't know what to make of it because it's not my beat. But you had Ayatollah Khomeini, who doesn't say much, kind of reaching out a little to Obama and saying, I hear you. This can't be bad because we think of Iran as being a totally irrational state. If there were somebody there to talk to work with that's listening, it's the most encouraging thing I've heard in a long time because, as Jack said, you know, there aren't any really good, there's no good road here.
Of course, you don't know what's a real conversation and what's just another step in chess game. Three-dimensional chess here and all kinds of players. Todd in Northboro, Massachusetts. Todd, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I am a supporter of Barack Obama and a longtime Democrat. I voted for him because I was scared of George W. Bush's executive power grab. But this week has made me concerned. Eric Holder saying it's okay to assassinate American citizens abroad, due process, being attacked. I'm very concerned that this isn't being spoken about in the media.
Let me say, first off, we're going to have a big conversation on that right here on Monday. Todd, we'll have the head of the ACLU and a top legal official from the Bush administration sort of have it out over what Eric Holder is saying. But yes, he's saying, you know, targeted killings, legal, and that is a highly debatable point, to say the least. Jessica, is there any, do you hear any misgiving around the White House about that? It certainly got a lot of heat in the Bush administration. Is it getting heat now?
It is astonishing. I have to say, as a member of the press corps, it was upsetting to me that we didn't get a chance to ask that question at the briefing, at the press conference last week. They cut the press conference much shorter than anybody expected it to be. And so I think, you know, we usually have a chance to get to a lot of different questions, and it just ended so abruptly. Listen, this administration has continued the policy of many of the policies of the Bush administration. They didn't close Gitmo. The president is, with these drone attacks, continuing stepping up the drone attacks. They think that it's not just great foreign policy in their mind, but also great politics, and that his, you know, strong stance on all these, it's a sign of his courageous leadership in their view. It is a very, I will tell you, very, very challenging issue to cover at the White House. It is because they won't touch it. It's the sort of topic that investigative reporters who are off the campus, who are not on the beat, have a much more successful time covering, because you have the freedom to go and dig through archives and find sources and press people who aren't actual White House officials. Because that's where the leaks are coming from. But the other thing I'd point out, if I could quickly, is that this administration has been much more aggressive about prosecuting people who do leak classified information than even the Bush administration was, which is something that the press has pointed out, but I think deserves even more attention than it's getting.
We're going to touch it right here big time on Monday, Eric Holder's speech on targeted killings and the U.S. Constitution. Lots of talk this week also about Syria, terrible scenes there of the Syrian military going after dissidents any number of places. The UN humanitarian chief Valerie Amos was in Syria this week, toured the Baba Amr neighborhood in Homs on Wednesday, said she was shocked there by the wreckage and, at that point, the emptiness.
The devastation there is significant. That part of Homs is completely destroyed, and I'm concerned to know what has happened to the people who lived in that part of the city.
Who lived. There are refugees now and a lot of people on the run. There was a big back and forth on Capitol Hill over this. Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta before the Senate Armed Services Committee on Wednesday saying that while the administration's watching Syria closely, he said it doesn't make sense for the U.S. to intervene with military support right now. Arizona Senator John McCain disagreed. Here's an exchange between Senator McCain and Leon Panetta.
As Secretary of Defense, before I recommend that we put our sons and daughters in uniform in harm's way, I've got to make very sure that we know what the mission is. I've got to make very sure that we know whether we can achieve that mission, at what price, and whether or not it'll make matters better or worse.
Well, let me tell you what's wrong with your statement. You don't mention American leadership. Americans should lead in this. America should be standing up. America should be building coalitions. We shouldn't have statements like, quote, that we are not going to intervene no matter what the situation is, such has been at least up until now the statements by the administration and the president. We're not leading, Mr. Secretary.
Jessica Yellen, you're there in the White House. They're talking to the Pentagon. Is there any conversation that you can hear about intervention in Syria? Is there real coalition building going on, the kind there was before the intervention in Libya? Or is this not just not actually on?
To paraphrase what the president said in response to gas prices during the press conference, do you really think he's going to intervene in Syria before the election? Is this good politics? I'm sorry, I don't want to be cynical, but I just don't see this, the White House taking this issue on in direct military intervention before the election.
Is BHA writes to us from Vermont. He says, thank our lucky stars McCain didn't get elected. He'd have us tossing stuff into Syria with no effective boots on the ground, local resistance, who goes in and does the hard work. On the other hand, it has been hard to watch those scenes of dissidents really taking it. High-level defection, we're told this week, from within the Syrian government, but that could go on a long time. Keystone XL pipeline and gas prices big this week. Newt Gingrich posing in front of at the gas pump on his southern swing. The president talking about it here in response at his press conference, talking about gas prices in response to a question from Fox News reporter Ed Henry.
Ed, just from a perspective, do you think the president of the United States going into re-election wants gas prices to go up higher? Is there anybody here who thinks that makes a lot of sense? Look, here's the bottom line with respect to gas prices. I want gas prices lower because they hurt families.
May not make sense for gas prices to go up politically, though. Secretary of Energy Stephen Chu has in the past said, and others have said, we need higher gas prices to make room for alternative energy sources to grow and prosper. We've got a response on both sides of this one here. We've got a listener in Massachusetts says, what's up with the president personally lobbying Senate Democrats to vote against the Keystone Pipeline? Doesn't Obama care about American jobs, energy security? Then Masha writes, we who are against it, Keystone, I guess, and truly care about jobs and energy independence, and we hope jobs can be found in clean energy, not at the cost that this particular oil supply comes with. Dirtiest possible oil would spell endgame for the environment. Margaret, what do you read in what happened there yesterday? There were Democrats voting with Republicans trying to order an advance on the Keystone Pipeline, but they didn't pull it off in the end. How does this one play out, Margaret?
Eventually, there's going to be a Keystone Pipeline.
Really?
Because it's an untenable political position to hold out on the basis of mostly of jobs, and then in the end, the gas. Listen, when you quote Cabinet Secretary Chu from several years ago, mm-hmm. you realize what can be said in a non-election year. He made a gaffe, which is accidentally saying what's true, which is, for conservation to happen, we have to have prices more like the Europeans in order for people to not drive every minute they want to and go to the mall for one thing. You know, that's how you do that. But drill, baby, drill is more politically feasible. you have to be seen to be doing everything, because the easiest political ad to make is one where you wrap yourself around a gas pump and show the 4.199 price.
Jack, what do you think the president is, his line these days is all of the above on domestic sources of energy. Can he hold that position and his opposition to the Keystone Pipeline? Do you think it's inevitable that this one gets built, Jack?
I think so. It sounded as if it was going to happen inevitably before the Republicans made it an issue some months ago, that they forced the pace on it. The State Department hadn't gone through all the permits and the safety issues, and so they had to turn it down. So it sounded as if it was headed in that direction. But, you know, on this gas price business, Newt Gingrich has already posed beside a pump, and he says, I'll get you gas for $2.50 a gallon. And an economist calculated, in fact, he could do that if every driver in New York City and in Los Angeles stopped driving. And or
not likely in LA anyway.
Yes, if the federal government put in a $187 billion subsidy, that could happen.
Well, we'll watch that Keystone Pipeline project, a kind of, I don't know if it's an Alamo, I don't know what it is, but certainly on the environmental wing of Obama's party, there is very strong opposition to that. On the other hand, you hear the cries for more energy and the president saying all of the above. What an interesting, jam-packed week it was. We're grateful to each of you for being with us to look at it. Jessica Yellen, Chief White House Correspondent for CNN. Thanks so much, Jessica.
Thank you for having me.
Margaret Carlson, Bloomberg News. Thanks, Margaret.
I made up for not speaking last
time. You did. Thanks, Jack. I'm Tom
Ashbrook.
This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.